Welcome to Parshas Tzav. Tzav is command. An interesting note about the word Tzav is that, yep, Tzav is part of mitzvah, so middle two letters, but we know there's a numerical value to each of the letters in the alphabet. And Tzav, the Tzadi, represents the number 90. And the Vav represents the number 6. It's 96. And if you count the verses in the Parsha Tzav, guess how many adds up to? 96. So that's always a little interesting note when we get to Tzav. But when you look at Tzav, it kind of seems that it is more of the same of the material of Vayikra. Namely, Vayikra was a parsha that introduced, for the most part, the korbanot, the sacrifices or offerings. And we coined a new translation phrase for korbanot last week. For those of you who are here, we will repeat it. Anybody remember? The word for the korbanot is close encounter. Because the word korban comes from, at its root, is karov, which is close. And a korban is a close encounter with Hashem. And tefillah, which is prayer, which is also, in our tradition, has a lot in common with korbanot, is also a close encounter with God. And we read from Rabbi Luzzatto's book, The Way of God, Derech Hashem, among God's acts of love was the opportunity that he gave man to approach him even in this world. Even though man is immersed in darkness and far from the light in his natural physical state, he is still permitted to stand before God and call him by his name. This is a description of prayer. Man is thus able to temporarily elevate himself from his lowly natural state to exist in a state of closeness to God, casting his burden upon him, as discussed earlier. And he goes on to explain the ritual of prayer is that when one is in the middle of prayer, one does not interrupt himself because he is at that moment locked in a very close embrace, if you will, with God, and should not interrupt that. And also this explains the ritual of the three steps. We take three steps, stepping into our position for the Amida, and when we are done, we take three steps backwards. This represents that man is changing his state. When he enters tefillah, he's locked in a kind of a time bubble with just he and God are. And when he finishes, he takes the three steps to represent that he's returning to his normal state spiritually. You know, it's almost as if while we are in prayer, we lose the confines, we lose the bounds that we normally have being in our physical state. We don't move. Some people shuckle. It helps them have kavana. We keep our feet together, which represents like an angel-like position. And we're really like in a different world when we daven. So this, and we presume that this was the element of korban that one would experience when the temple stood. So when we open up Parshas Tzav, we see more about korbanos, more about the rituals associated with the temple, which are, of course, unfortunately not applicable to us today. And that really is the beginning of Tzav, and that's really the end of Tzav. What is new and different in terms of the korbanos that we find in Tzav that we did not find in Vayikra? It's not an obvious difference, but when one looks into it and reads some of the commentaries, one sees a new dimension. Vayikra contained what's known as the korbanos yachid, the offering, the korban of the individual. There was the elevation offering, the ola, the meal offering, the mincha, the peace offering, the shlamim, the sin offering, the chatas, and the guilt offering, the asham. They were all taken by individuals at particular times. Some of them were voluntary. Some of them were in the event that a sin was committed that needed an atonement. These are all irregular offerings brought by the individual. So, our association with that would be that when an individual finds in his or her life the need or the opportunity to have a close encounter with God, he or she does so. And that's what a korban is. But in Tzav we learn that there are other types of korbanos. The parsha begins by describing the ola, the elevation offering that stays on the flame, on the altar, all night until the morning, and describes a daily ritual of cleaning the korban, the altar, from the ashes. And it seems that this is something that is a daily occurrence. There's a daily ola, a daily elevation offering. And when we look at the commentaries, they tell us that this refers to the daily continual offering, tamid, that involves the entire nation. The morning tamid is the key offering of the day. In other words, there's a korban that is brought by the community and is brought every single day. And that is obligatory.
Does that map to any prayers today, that offering?
As a matter of fact, the daily prayers, as it turns out, that we're familiar with, Shacharis, Mincha, and Maariv, do not relate to the korbanos in Parshas Vayikra at all. The korbanos in Parshas Vayikra are do it whenever you by yourself and whenever you want. No set time. The korbanos, the tefillos, the prayers that we do have to do with obligatory communal korbanos that take place every single day, day in and day out. That's what our prayers. We don't, how many people take the time to do a voluntary prayer? We do sometimes, but most people, the time that they spend in prayer is the time that we are doing so because we are obliged to do so. And it is a prayer that we do in the context of a minyan, of a community, of a congregation. That is something that expands our notion of what a korban is. Because one could ask some questions, and I think this is maybe one of the most commonly asked questions that people who are not familiar with the regular ritual of an observant lifestyle ask. If a prayer, they ask something like this, and I'm sure you've asked it or heard it, being asked. If prayer is a experience of closeness to God, why then are the rabbis telling me when I have to pray? And they're telling me what I have to say in my prayer. Shouldn't it be up to me? Shouldn't it be spontaneous? Shouldn't it be an expression of my own feelings and my own desires and my own requests? Why do I have to read it out of a formula of a book? And why do I have to do it every day and only I can't do it after 10 o'clock, it's too late? What's going on here? And how does that, and it's a good question, how does this, how does our definition of the Derech Hashem that we read yesterday, stepping into God's space and an opportunity to stand before Him and call Him by His name, why does that have to be dictated by time and place and context and daily? And once we're talking about that, I think that some other questions really come into mind. We've talked about, we've quoted the often quoted saying from Pirkei Avos, Ethics of the Fathers, that on three things the world stands: Torah, which is Torah study; Avoda, which is either the korbanos, the offerings of the temple, or prayer. And that Avoda means service. And then Gemilus Chasadim, acts of kindness. The world stands on these three things. So two questions. Number one, why is prayer or korbanos called avodah? Avodah means work. Avodah means comes from the word eved, servant. It's something that we have to do. It's something that we're working for God. That's not what we thought prayer was. We didn't think that prayer was work. We thought that prayer was a conversation, something that I do to have a close encounter with God. You don't call that work. You don't call that service. And neither did we think Karbanos was work or service. But it was an opportunity to come close to God, like in Vayikra. It was a voluntary thing. And also, number two, why does the world, what does it mean the world stands on these three pillars? If we take that literally, that means that if nobody would pray, if nobody would bring Karbanos, what would happen?
You'd only stay almost 2 feet so long and you'd fall over.
You wouldn't be able to stand. Think of it as a tripod. Your tripod can't stand at all if you take one away the leg. And even Torah and Gemilus Chasadim, if mitzvahs in general are opportunities for people to on their own choice, to have a connection with God, as we have developed this theme throughout the many weeks of Shemos, why will the world cease to stand just because people are not doing mitzvahs? They'll lose out. They won't have that connection with God, perhaps. But why does that mean the world will cease to exist? If nobody chooses to pray, nobody chooses to study Torah, the world will truly not exist. Why should that be? And now, to add to our list of questions, I want to add something which is very timely. Because we find ourselves now in a situation of uncertainty, of danger. And although people are trying their best to carry on business as normal, and perhaps we should do that, but there's no question that there have been certain forces of evil in the world that have come to a head. And people are at war now, and our American brothers and sisters are putting their lives at risk at this very moment. And we know in Israel, throughout the decades, has been the same. Now, there are some people in this world, I happen to know a lot of them, so do you. They maintain that they are helping with security, protecting the Jewish community in Israel, by doing things such as studying Torah, prayer, and acts of kindness. They make the claim that their involvement in these mitzvos are doing as much, if not more, to ensure and secure the safety of the Jewish people. How can they make such a claim? How can you compare a spiritual act when times are at peril, when there is an enemy, and the enemy must be dealt with, seemingly with ammunition, with guns, with manpower? How can you make a claim that spiritual acts have anything to do with that? And there are, to the extent that there are people that their philosophy is that they are exempt from serving in the armed forces because they are involved in spiritual acts. Okay, we've all heard about this. Some of us may be uncomfortable with it. Let's ask the question point blank. How can they make such a claim? And I would suggest that we all buy into that somewhat, because we know that when at times of danger, we gather together and we do the same thing. We say, let's have an extra study session. Let everyone gather together and let us say Psalms. Let's say Tehillim and let's study more. Now, why do we think that that's going to make a difference? What's that got to do with the situation 6,000 miles away on the battlefield? Why do we think that by reciting Tehillim, it's going to make a difference who wins the war?
Would you not relate it to the story of Esther? Isn't that what happened?
Okay, good example. We read about it in the book of Esther. Everybody bears witness to the fact that when the Jews were faced with a threat of annihilation, Esther gathered them together and said, fast. And gathered together. Why does that have anything to do with the threat? And we see that it worked. It worked. So we think we have to understand the relationship between the spiritual and the physical reality of danger. Okay. Gentlemen and ladies. Ladies and gentlemen. I think we have to go back to our source, to Derech Hashem, to Rabbi Luzzatto, and speak about some things that you may think are a little bit hocus pocus, a little far out, maybe mystical. But I think that we are raising questions, and I think that we all live and practice certain things which must to be understood on an adult, on a mature, on a sophisticated level, must involve certain assumptions and principles which we may not have heard when we were children. And we must expand our horizons and listen to the words of our tradition. None of these things that I'm telling you are things that, you know, anybody would claim I don't believe it, because I think we kind of mimic these, echo these expressions from time to time. Maybe we just haven't integrated them into a systematic approach. Let me try, and I'm just going to call it an attempt to put down a few ideas that I have gleaned from the writings of Rabbi Luzzatto in two different chapters, and see how that can shed light on the questions that we've asked today. Okay, the first principle to set down is that, and maybe I'll read just one paragraph or so. God created a world, we've spoken about the world to come and this world. Today we're only going to speak about this world, okay? But what does this world mean? The world has two parts, the physical and the spiritual. Okay, we know that because we are living in this world and we have a physical and a spiritual. But the world also has a physical and a spiritual aspect. The physical is that which we experience with our senses. That can be divided into terrestrial and astronomical. Astronomical includes all things that cost a lot of money. Astronomical includes the heavenly bodies as the stars and their planets. The terrestrial includes everything in the lower sphere, the earth, water, and atmosphere, and every detectable thing that they contain. The spiritual world consists of all entities which are not physical and which cannot be detected by physical means. These are divided into categories: souls and transcendental beings. Souls comprise a class of spiritual entities destined to enter physical bodies. Transcendental beings comprise a class of spiritual entities that are not meant to be associated with physical bodies. Can you give me a term which we all use, and it's all in our prayers, that are spiritual beings that are not destined to be put into bodies?
Malachim.
What are malachim? Angels. We all talk about angels. But what are they? They are spiritual entities. The transcendental beings also exist on different levels, each having an inherent nature depending on its level and place in the general scheme. Okay, I'm not going to go too much into this now. We are well aware of physical things and their natural properties and laws, but spiritual concepts, on the other hand, are outside of our realm of experience and therefore cannot be adequately described. When we speak of spiritual entities and phenomena, we must therefore rely completely on the traditions handed down to us. Let's suffice it to say this. There's a saying in the Gemara. One of the rabbis was said, he knew the pathways of heaven as well as he knew the streets of his city. The heaven has pathways. What that means to me is as follows. We are all well aware that this is a very, very complex physical universe. And we know that everything has an order, everything has a structure, everything has a system. And we're duly impressed with the complexity of the world that God created. science, mathematics, astronomy. We are duly aware and impressed by the complexity and the precision of the physical realm. Let's just, therefore, assume that in the spiritual realm, things are just as precise, just as orderly. There is cause and effect in the spiritual realm just as there is in the physical realm. There's no reason to assume not. Only difference is that we can't sense it. We can't perceive it with our own senses. But it's there. Just as there's a complex set of roads and highways that connect places to each other, there are pathways in heaven too. And I don't mean the next world, I mean this world, but the spiritual realm of this world. You'll see where this is leading more practical as we develop it further. Now, let's learn one principle about the physical realm. We have laws of nature. There's a law of gravity. There's different processes. Let's mention one of the laws of nature in the spiritual realm. One of these fundamentals is that everything in the physical world has a counterpart among the transcendental forces. Every world, every entity and process in the physical world is linked to these forces, following a system decreed by God's wisdom. Okay, that means that everything in the physical world has a connection with something in the spiritual world. An example, an analogy, just to make this a little bit easier to understand. Think of a puppet. Think of a puppet show. You're in the audience of a professional puppet production. You see the puppets dancing in front of you. They look like they're moving their hands and they're dancing and they're talking, right? Now the person who knows what's going on knows that up in the balcony, behind stage, are puppeteers who are pulling the strings and causing the puppets to make every movement that they make. The puppets are not really moving on their own. They're not automated. So is a similar type thing between physical entities and the spiritual entities. If a tree grows, there is a little, I don't know if it's an angel exactly, but it's some spiritual force that is connected with the growth of that tree. God programs that spiritual entity to send a message down to the tree to make the tree grow. It's not only the physical process, it's not only the photosynthesis or whatever the physical natural phenomena that's working, there's also a spiritually entity involved in that tree's growth too.
Is that the source, is that the explanation for thought that physical is linked to spiritual? Nothing can happen in the physical world without God being.
That's
involved.
A fundamental. That's an axiom.
Okay.
That's an axiom, which is that comes down from our tradition. I can't prove it to you. But that's the axiom.
So because God is involved in it, that makes it spiritual.
That's how God created the world. In other words, let me say one of our 13 fundamental principles of faith is that God not only created the world, but God continues to run the world. This is an explanation of how, right? You know, to a child, a physical phenomenon just happens. How did the baby get born? The baby was inside the mommy's tummy, and then it came out. Okay, but of course, there's a whole cause and effect, a whole process that went into that. But to the child, he just says, the baby came out of mommy. So you could say, God made the tree. But the more sophisticated explanation is that God created a whole system of spiritual entities that are linked to the trees and linked to the grass and the animals and so forth. And God created that system, that network, and that's why the tree grows. It comes from God, but it's through forces.
That's what I was.
that's really where I'm heading.
Yeah, it's a more
that explanation gets. I want to say older child, but tired, but it'll diminish. Yeah, my simple view of the world. What the meaning of spiritual really is has to go beyond God made it so or God said so. It's got to have. There's got to be more to that story, more depth to it, more fabric, and that's what I'm probing for. There must be sources here that you're alluding to and not explicitly telling me about.
All I know is what's in here, and I just read, you know, what I read to you is basically what it is. One of these fundamentals says when we speak of spiritual entities and phenomena, we must. It's outside of our realm of experience, therefore we must therefore rely completely on the traditions handed down to us. And one of these fundamentals is that everything in the physical world has a counterpart among the transcendental forces. These forces are therefore the roots of all physical things. Everything in the physical world is a branch and a result of these forces. The two are thus bound together like links in a chain. We know from tradition that every physical entity and process is under the charge of some type of angel. The angels have the responsibility of maintaining each of them as well as bringing about changes within them according to God's decree. That's all I know.
All right, well, that's already new to me.
But it is new. I know. We've talked about angels, we've talked about trees, but we never really thought about what the link is. Okay, let's continue. There's one entity that exists in the world that is not governed by spiritual entities. It has its own governing ability. Can anyone guess what that is? That's simpler than that. There's one physical entity that exists in the world that is not a puppet. Usually. Come on. What happened to Pinocchio?
The human being.
The human being is not a puppet. How do we know that? The human being was created with what's called bechira.
Choice.
God gave the human being freedom of choice. You know what it says? Man was created in the image of God. You know what that means? According to some commentators, that means that God made man autonomous. Just like God.
But could you call our soul the counterpart?
Yeah, but we control when the soul comes into our body and placed on this world, the soul is at the mercy, if you will, of the entire human being. The soul has its desire, has its inclination. The human being has Yetzer Tov, Yetzer Hara. And ultimately, the human being, with his mind and his all his capacities, is going to make whatever choice he chooses to make.
Is the model of that the good and the bad pulls, are those internal or external?
Both. Okay, we'll get to that. The human being definitely has a good and evil force within him. There are also good and evil forces in the world outside of man. Now, that means that God does not dictate via his angels or via his spiritual entities to the human being what to do. Now, let me just point out, he can if he wants. God can take away Bechira, can suspend Bechira from a human being. We see this in the Torah many times. We see that God hardened Pharaoh's heart, and Pharaoh would not let the Jewish people go, even though when left to his own choice, he would have said, let them go. He had said, let them go. But God hardened his heart and he changed his words. Hardening of the heart means suspension in a great measure of the freedom of will. Another example we have in the Torah is the prophet Bilam, who was hired to curse the Jewish people. And that he didn't want anything more than to curse the Jewish people. And when he opened his mouth, all that came out were words of blessing. He became a puppet. But God doesn't do that very often. That's one of the last things that God resorts to. Okay, so here we have a contrast. We have said initially that every physical phenomenon originates among these highest forces, and therefore those physical phenomena become what the author calls natural determinism. They are determined, predetermined. They don't have a say in the matter. The tree has no choice. whether it wants to grow or not wants to grow. That's determined by the upper forces. If the tree lives or the tree dies, that will be predetermined by the upper forces. If the an animal has basically also a predetermined instinct. It was programmed with an instinct that it will always run away from danger and so forth. Human being is the only creation that is not driven by natural determinism. He has what is called an indeterministic influence, which means that he calls the shots. Now, what happens when man calls the shots? Okay, here's another piece in the puzzle. There is a two-way street going between physical world and spiritual world. You have influences coming from up to down, from the natural forces, and coming down and determining and controlling physical occurrences. And then you have influences that come from down to up. That is, when man makes a choice, that sends up an influence up to the upper forces and influences them. And they now become influenced by man's choices. And that will affect the kind of influence that will in turn send back down. An analogy was once given of a rope. You have a rope hanging down from the middle of a ceiling, let's say in a gym. What happens when you take that rope and you shake it? Okay, it sends a ripple up the rope to the very top. And what happens to that ripple after it reaches the top? It reciprocates and sends another ripple down. Here we have God influencing the world from up to down, and man influencing the world from down to up. And that in turn creates a ripple effect from up to down again. I'll give you an example. I'll tell you first a story which you can dismiss as have anything to do with the spiritual realm, but you'll see kind of like an analogy. There's this famous story of this man from Texas. He wasn't a particularly religious man, but he was a generous man. He was a wealthy man. And he was visiting Israel. And he went to the wall, and he saw a lone Jew standing there next to the wall, obviously a very religious, pious man, and he watched him as he was davening. And he saw the man with such an outpour of expression. He was crying. He was clearly davening from the depths of his heart. And the man from Texas was so moved. He had never seen a grown man be so emotional or fervent in a religious way. And he says to himself, when I get home, I'm going to make a donation to a cause that, you know, people that are like him. I'm going to go find an Orthodox institution and make a big donation. And sure enough, he went back home and he donated, I think it was to a kollel or to a day school, a large sum of money, and he continued thereafter to support this institution. All doesn't know anything about that, right? But they say that when the man from the wall goes up after 120 years, they're gonna usher him into the waiting room upstairs, and they can say, "Psh, here's the man that built the day school in Dallas," and he's gonna say, "Ma ani lo mevin, you know, ani lo yodeh ma ze Dallas. What is Dallas? I never heard of the place." And they're going to show him the spiritual videotape, and it's going to show how his prayer in Jerusalem affected a chain reaction which helped Jewish institutions in Dallas. Okay, this is obviously not a direct illustration of our point, but what we're saying is akin to that. That even if the man from Dallas didn't see the man praying at the wall, who knows? Still, the man praying at the wall could still, in the realm of possibility, affect Jewish life in Dallas. How? Because his prayer goes up to the upper world and influences the general force and sends back a spiritual censor, message that could go anywhere. I'll give you an example which I think is a good illustration of this from the Torah. In the Parsha of Noach, what happened? says there that God saw the world and saw that the world was needed to be destroyed. And one of the problems with the world is that kishiches kol basar darko al haaretz, all flesh had corrupted its way on the earth. What does it mean, the all flesh had corrupted its way? If you look in Rashi, it says that the people were homosexual, and the animals started to be homosexual. Now, why would the animals become homosexual? I know that people have these things. Why would animals become homosexual because the people were? You could see they saw. I don't know if the animals would necessarily draw a parallel that they saw and they said, oh, that's a good idea. I don't think it worked that way. The explanation that's given is that because man, by their using their choice, corrupted, filled the world with a certain form of corruption, it strengthened the evil influence from the world that sent up an influence on the upper forces, and that came back down and affected the physical world in ways that even man hadn't considered, and it actually influenced the animals. That's an example of this ricochet, this boomerang effect. Okay, now we're almost there, because we know that God created the world with good forces and bad forces, both within man and the world in general. And that was that basic premise in the whole of this book, is that in order for man to achieve closeness to God, he would have to be placed in a world that had a balance of good and evil, so that he could choose good, and he could earn the goodness and the closeness because he had chosen it. Therefore, God had to create a balance between the good and the evil. But what we know now is that the balance between the good and evil forces, both down here from us and also from above, can shift. You can have a strengthening of the forces of good, which would weaken the forces of evil, and you could have the reverse. You could have the forces of evil getting strengthened and weakening the forces of good in the world. And here's another example from the Torah where this is shown. We read in Purim, Amalek attacked the Jewish people. When did Amalek attack the Jewish people? If you look in the Chumash, what we read on Purim, it says the Jewish people said they questioned God. They said, "Is God amongst us or not?" And the very next verse is Vayavo Amalek. Okay, Amalek came. And the way they defeated Amalek was that Moshe went and sat on the mountain and he raised his hand. And the Torah says when his hand was raised, the Jewish people were strong over Amalek. And when he lowered his hands, the Jewish people lost, were losing. What does that have to, what is raising of the hand? Raising of the hand means that the Jewish people were focused upward. This is what the sages tell us. And they were concentrating on God in their hearts. And when they raise their spiritual level, thereby strengthening the forces of good in the world, the forces of evil were weakened. Amalek was weakened. The physical phenomena of Amalek was weakened because the Jewish people strengthened the force of good in the world.
So why did they state it in a physical way, that his hands were tired and that they propped his hands so that they would be up and they could win?
The Torah in general doesn't talk about all this that we're talking about. That's beneath the surface. The Torah speaks in a language that is easy for anyone to understand, even children. But there's a whole level, there's levels of how to understand the Torah. Okay. What were our questions? Our questions are, why do we have karbanos that are obligatory every day, particularly in the morning, and they have to be done communally and have to be done day in and day out? There's one more little piece in this puzzle which answers that immediately. The highest wisdom ordained that the night should be a time when the forces of evil have the authority to proliferate in all their vehicles and cause their offshoots in the world to move about freely. Okay? God gives free rein to the forces of evil at night. The reason why it's dark at night, that's also corresponds, physical darkness also corresponds to the spiritual realm. Because what is evil in this world? Evil is when God hides his presence, and good is when God reveals his presence.
Could it be that at night all of us are sleeping, and so there's an absence of that energy that's going up, to the positive energy?
Okay, the question is, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Here he says is the intention was so that people should remain at home sleeping and resting until the morning. Now, there's other thing. The God needed the evil forces to have their time. He mentions that also. To me, I think of it like there are two armies. There's the good army and the evil army, and they're both essential for the world, and God has to keep them both in shape. And of course, God wants to tip the side on the side of good, and so he says to the evil army, he says, you can have your practice sessions at night, and I'll make sure that the people are sleeping so you won't do too much damage. I got to give you some time to exercise, so to speak. So you can have the night, and they'll have the day.
That's when the clubs are open.
But,
right.
But what about the people, all their souls are with God at night?
Yeah.
So what's the evil going to do with them?
Well, they're just out there roaming. For example, things like you see in Pirkei Avos. It says, if you stay up at night and you're not studying, you're living dangerously. You're playing with your life. Night is a time for sleeping or resting or doing very heavy-duty spiritual activities in order to counteract. It's a great time for learning. It's a great time for studying. And some people stay up very late studying Torah at night. Maybe the daytime they don't have as much time. That's okay. But to stay up at night and to go walking around and idling your time is living dangerously. You can do that in the daytime. Now, so there's this shift, changing of the guards every night. Every morning, when the morning comes, authority is taken away from these forces and their offshoots, and people can once again go about their occupations until nightfall. All this is explained in the Psalm 104, which we say on Rosh Chodesh, you make darkness and it is night. And all the beasts of the forest creep forth. The sun rises and they slink away. Man then goes forth to his work and to his labor until evening. This is the book of Psalms. You know, what's that book? Where the wild things grow. Yeah, that's based on this here. Now, the fact that these forces... Okay. Now... So they clear away, but the good forces have been kind of laying dormant all night long. So when we arise in the morning, number one, we have to wake up to a state of spiritual lessening. Even when we were sleeping, we were not on the same spiritual level. The sages say that sleeping is like a 60th of death. And when we wake up, there is a certain, what the sages call a tuma, contaminated spirit which rests over us, and we have to remove that spirit, and that's why we were ordained to wash our hands, negel baser, and that removes the residual contamination which was on our hands throughout the night. And if we don't wash our hands, we really shouldn't go around walking around and touching things. We do; it's a very important thing, washing the hands in the morning. But the point is that we need to get the forces of evil regenerated. And we, who have Bechira, who have choice, have the power to influence, are called upon by God to help facilitate the rejuvenation of the good forces in the world every morning. And therefore he says to you, gentlemen, ladies, you have all day, anytime you want, to come to me and to pray and bring a korban if you like, but I need to ask you that at least from the hours of 6 a.m. to 8 a.m., I need you to be on duty. And I need you to work for me to jumpstart the day. And I need you to do karbanos, and I need you to do certain mitzvahs. I need you to put on the talis, and I need you, the men, to put on tefillin. And you're working for me now. I've got you. After that, you can go about your business. But during these few hours of the day, and once again, I need you again near nightfall before we go into the next period of darkness. I need you to work for me too, and set up a shield. During that time, we are working. We are avadim. We are servants of God. We're not praying to Him because we felt motivated to do so, but we are praying to Him because He asked us to do that. That's part of the maintenance of the balance of good and evil in the world. And that's why prayer is called avodah. And that's why we had to do it communally. This is not about each person finding his own time to connect with God. That you can do any time of the day. During the morning hours, we're on duty, we're on call, we're working for God.
But we didn't have that before. In temple times...
Well, temple started right after the Torah, as soon as they had the Mishkan. There's actually, I saw in the commentary, there was a machlokas where they brought the daily offering during the 40 years of the desert, or they only started it after they came into Israel. Maybe during the 40 years of the desert they didn't need it. The good was there.
That's what I thought. The prayers were developed because we lost touch. We didn't have temple anymore.
Yeah.
Men didn't know how to talk to God. They didn't know how to express themselves. So.
Well, before the prayers, it was the karbanos themselves. There was always a daily avodah. There was always a daily service, which was either in the form of karbanos or in the form of tefilos.
But those were those the individual?
Those were the communal. Yeah. The olas hatamid, one it's in the morning, one sheep in the morning, and one sheep in the afternoon. That was always obligatory.
So our prayers now are the same as
those. Right. Our shacharis and our mincha and our mariv are not the personal ones. They're the ones that take the place of the karbanos, which have to do with being God's partners in maintaining the good balance of the world.
So that's avodah.
That's avodah. So that explains some of our questions. We asked, why is there obligatory prayer? We asked, why is there communal prayer? Why does it have to be done every day? Why is it called avodah? Why would the world not be able to stand without it? Well, if we don't get up in the morning and increase and put back the forces of good into the world, eventually the world will remain under the strength of the forces of evil, and eventually the world will not be able to exist. God did not create us to live in a world where we will be dominated by forces of evil such that we will not be able to choose out of it. And the world will cease to exist. That's what happened at the time of the flood. There was too much evil in the world. There was not enough being generated from down here, and that affected everything. Everything became corrupt.
So if you had to stand on a street corner today, what would you put on your sign?
Watch the traffic.
What would I put on the sign?
Yeah. Prayer or action.
Work for
if we don't daven tomorrow morning, the world will come to an end. It's not just davening. Torah, avodah, and gebilus chasadim, all of these is what creates the force of good. Now, going back to our other questions about what's going on with this war, what are we doing about it? How come there are people here that claim that they're doing a lot by sitting and studying? I have to tell you, based on what I read here, I have to admit that they've got a very good point. Let's assume that we had the best army, with the best ammunition, with the best training, with the best manpower. But let's say that spiritually there were not good signals being sent from here up to the heavenly sphere. Would we win? Would we be safe? Or would we be in danger? Everything that happens in the physical world is governed by a spiritual entity. And God can take things over. God can, when he ordains, He can intervene. He can make an army win. He can make an army lose. That all depends on the kind of signals that are being sent up there from down here. We absolutely especially in times of danger, we absolutely have to strengthen the forces of good. We have to strengthen the Torah. We have to strengthen the Avoda. We have to strengthen the Gemilus Chasadim. Absolutely. That's what's going to make a real difference. That's what made the difference in the war with Amalek, which was the first anti-Semitic war, wasn't it? And that's what continues to charge it. And even the people out there in the battlefield, they've got to understand if they want to, you know, if they want to really benefit and receive God's blessing. And everybody says we're praying. Everyone's saying we're praying, right? What does that mean? We have to recognize that what happens down here is dictated from above, and we have to. The people that are in the battlefield, and if they have the ability, they have the motivation, then maybe they should be doing that. But let them also realize that the generator, what's generating the positive force, the spiritual forces in the world, which ultimately dictates our outcome, is in the hands of people that are doing Torah, Havodah, and Gemilus Chasadim. And we need them. And, you know, I guess we have to work together, but we have to recognize what each one is doing. But this is major. This is not just some. This is not a cop out. It's not a cop out. On the contrary, this is where our strength comes from. So these are important things. It's part of our tradition. It's part of our consciousness. But thanks to Rabbi Luzzatto, he explains it and enunciates it clearly for us in a very very matter-of-fact way, and it should enhance our experience. It should enhance what we do when we pray. We're literally soldiers. We are God's army all the time, every day of the year, every year in the world. We're always called upon to be soldiers, to be on the forces fighting for the forces of evil, for forces of good. And we have to realize that in times such as this, we have to strengthen our efforts, and that we're really making the difference. And it is on our deeds, Torah, Avodah, and Gemilus Chasadim, that the world stands.
Nice.